Tonight on The Good Atheist, I interview the author of Trials of the Monkey, an accidental memoir, and the director of the new thriller The Ledge, Matthew Chapman.
Welcome, my special co-host today. He is what I guess we could call, and he'll probably hate that I use this, the equivalent of atheist royalty, ladies and gentlemen. We have here a descendant of Charles Darwin, and if we were the superstitious folk and the folk to do that, we would have him as royalty. Fortunately, I get to call him by his first name because he's just that real. We'll be talking about all these things that he's done, accomplishments over the years, which I'm sure he'll just totally underwrite. We'll start with your involvement in something called Science Debate 2008. I don't know if everybody's got like amnesia, forgot about what it was like. Particularly in 2007, an article that I was researching because I was being a bit obsessive for the interview. And you wrote about a particular debate that was going on. I think it was about a Senator Brownback, and you had basically kind of, I guess, spoken on behalf of everyone who's got common sense, saying here were all these candidates that had failed to lift their hands when they had been asked if they believed in the theory of evolution. So you laid it on them pretty good. And there was a story that you said about your father. And the story was that basically he was, if you made a statement, it wouldn't be over until it was resolved. And I kind of wonder, I'm like, is that your personality? Is that what you're like in general?
Well, I think everybody should be like that, don't you? I mean, this is the whole problem, is that people accept information without checking up on it. I mean, what about those guys who, you know, said it was going to be the end of the world? I mean, how difficult is it to look at a little bit, go on the internet and say, end of the world predictions, you know, and you'll find like 700 of them. My dad was like obsessive about that. He had this sort of encyclopedia and reference books right by the dining room table. And so when I saw this ridiculous debate with these presidential candidates, and three of them said they didn't really buy into evolution, I just thought that was kind of willful ignorance. And, you know, not to be mean to them, because, you know, maybe they were challenged as children in terms of education, but it just seemed ridiculous. And I that was really what started me on the whole science debate thing, that, you know, not just that science is important to the Western, to the world in terms of, you know, medical advances and all the rest of it, but just as a way of thinking rationally about politics or life or someone trying to sell you something. There is a sort of scientific method that you can apply whereby you find out what the likely truth is.
Right.
And it's just, I find it very weird the way people don't use their critical faculties at all.
You decided to spearhead, I guess, a grassroots campaigns around this time. I'm trying to trace here. I don't know if you had any plans to that at the time you wrote the article, but it seems like kind of a logical progression, at least to me, of saying, well, after seeing that, it seemed as though you probably felt something's got to be done, particularly as the intelligent design movement has really been, like, we credit where credit is due. There's plenty of fucking nonsense out there, but very little that is as successful as this kind of nonsense. Like, congratulations, guys. You made the fucking grown-up table of nonsense. Yay.
Yeah. By the time I wrote that Brownback article, I'd been through the big Dover, Kitzmiller v. Dover trial in Pennsylvania, which was all about this. And
and the subject of your book, 40 Days and 40 Nights, which also has the other part of the title is Darwin Intelligent Design, God, OxyContin, and Other Oddities on Trial. OxyContin, do you care to share maybe that little bit?
Oh, that's a gem. The guy who, I mean, this is, you know, you couldn't believe this stuff if it wasn't real. The guy who was deciding what kinds of science books should be bought for the ninth grade class in Dover, Pennsylvania, was an OxyContin addicted prison guard. with almost no education whatsoever. In fact, he had so little education that even when the trial happened, and he'd had like a year and a half to prepare, when they asked him to define what intelligent design was and what evolution was, his description of intelligent design was actually pretty close to what evolution is. And his description of evolution was pretty close to creationism. He just didn't have a clue. And this was the guy. He was the head of the kind of textbook element of this fundamentalist cabal that had taken over the school board in this tiny town. This was the guy who was going to select textbooks and say, okay, this book of pandas and people, it was called, which is it.
Oh, yeah. That fucking monument to ignorance. Like, how thick is
it?
Oh,
my. It's a pamphlet. It's unbelievable. And the joke of it is, really, you know, because really it's all bullshit. It's all complete bullshit. It's just creationism. You know, it's like God did it. And, you know, they wanted equal time for the theory of evolution and creationism. God did it 8,000 years ago. That's all you can say, really. How do you have equal time for these two theories? It was an absurdity. I met people down there that I couldn't believe the things they were saying.
I recall an interview I was overhearing. I forget which one it was, but you were actually saying that Pennsylvania was worse than, I think you said, Virginia, or I forget which one you said.
Tennessee.
Yeah, that you said it was just, which I feel is a bit unexpected, I suppose, because, I mean, you don't think Pennsylvania, you don't necessarily associate with religious fanaticism, but yeah.
It's like a 2 to 3 hour drive from New York City, this place that I'm talking about, you know. It was really, and what's even more sad, actually, is that Pennsylvania was one of the most religiously liberal states in America in the early days. It was, you know, there was truly a desire that all religions would come there, all would be tolerated. And what I experienced there was a kind of religious intolerance and bullying, such as you'd never see in Tennessee. I mean, the town I was doing research in Tennessee, which had its comic aspects too, because it was this town where the Scopes monkey trial had happened, this very famous trial in 1925. And there was a fundamentalist college there called William Jennings Bryan College. And I went on a spelunking trip, you know, where you go into the caves with a creationist science teacher, a creationist professor, you know, so he'd be pointing to all these kind of ancient shrimp on the roof of this cave and saying, well, the flood came through here and the flood pushed that up 6,000 years ago. This guy had studied with Stephen Jay Gould, one of the leading evolutionary professors at Harvard. And he had gone through like 5 or 6 years studying under this guy and went in as a creationist and came out as a creationist. Wow. You know, like willful stuff. And I was stuck in this cave with all these nutty Christians banging their boots on the floor and everything. It was absolutely terrifying and hilarious at the same time.
You know what that is a kind of an indictment of? That he was a student of Stephen Jay Gould? I'm like, I guess Noma don't mean shit, does it?
No, if you got those views, they're pretty impermeable. You know, you can throw a nuclear bomb at someone who believes stuff like that, and they're still going to come out the other side of it, believing whatever it is they believe.
Well, then where does that place you and me? Because I feel to some degree like I was talking to, I mean, everyone who has either met you or talked to you has always told me such nice things about you. It was kind of ridiculous. I'm like, everyone's telling me like, he's so nice and you guys are going to get along because you have a very similar personality type and blah, blah. And with that, if that's true, then you realize that as people who are like, well, I'm not going to just fucking sit by while you have completely fucking retarded opinions and just let it slide. I'm not going to let it slide anymore. I mean, that's the feeling I got when I read not only that article, but also sort of like what you were trying to do with the science debate, which when you read about it, I guess the cool thing is that I guess the way that it turned out was that you didn't get to have all the questions that you wanted to have asked televised in the debate between McCain and Obama. But in the process, from what I understand, if Wikipedia is correct, it says that most of the people that ended up being part of the organization also being ended up being part of the Obama administration. Was that like a positive element? Did it work out well?
Yeah, but I don't quite know how it worked out because, you know, obviously I wasn't privy to all that. But they, the Stephen Chu, who's the Stephen Chu, John Holdren, and Jane Lubchenco, who is the sort of the science, if you like, the science advisory team to the president, were all members of Science Debate. And when we asked them, you know, I mean, this is comic. We negotiated with them very heavily, and as the sort of pack narrowed down to McCain and his genius sidekick Sarah Palin, and
you kind sir,
yeah, I mean, she really is. She's perfect for a reality show, but that's not for anyway. When it narrowed down to that, too, I mean, the pressure was building. We had 40,000 people in our group pushing for a science debate, and it's so obviously the right thing to do. We had 20 Nobel laureates, we had 10 Crayford laureates, we had
the real deals, bam!
Oh man, we had I think we had 120 American university presidents. We had the head of Texas Instruments and people from Intel. You know, we had it covered. So they were feeling the pressure. And we narrowed it down. We had PBS, Nova, and Now, the news show, on board. We had the Franklin Museum in Philadelphia. And we had a date. And all of this was kind of narrowing down, and they were appearing. You know, we were negotiating with their staff, and it looked like they were going to do it. And we were so happy. And then we get the news that on that day, they've actually decided to do a debate at Messiah College on faith and values.
Oh, God. Okay, wait. I think I can sum up this story even more beautifully with a wonderful analogy. You were sort of like that nerdy, blossoming young woman who's the valedictorian who gets asked by the popular kid to come to the prom only to find out the night of the prom that he's going with the bimbo queen.
It was
popularity, and it's like, oh no, you didn't. So predictable. Come on now.
Yeah. We didn't just get a no. We got a stick up the ass, is what we got.
That is.
It was devastating. But to their credit, they then went on and answered the 14 most important questions in the science policy area, which you know, we'd synthesized through our membership. You know, what do you want to have answered? They answered this online in writing, both candidates. And we had 850, we made, I'm not quite sure what this means actually, but I'm always saying
impressions, right? The impressions.
Yeah, we made 850 million media impressions.
I don't know what that means either.
No, I have no idea, but it's a big number.
Yeah, the fair thing is, forget the word media impressions, because it clouds the issue. You know, when someone said, I think I made an impression at this interview. Well, I think that goes the same way, where at least you, for some fucking reason, have an ability to actually measure that.
Yeah.
It's a huge fucking number. So you can say, we made an impression. You can literally say that, and you have fucking data to back it up, man. Awesome.
But you know what's kind of like, beyond that, you know what's kind of disgraceful about this whole process? We had these 14 questions. They're like the most important questions in life, really. You know, I mean, the future of our kids will be determined by how we deal with polluted water, polluted air, the ozone layer.
The important fucking questions.
I mean, this is really the future of the earth we're talking about here. We had their answers to these questions. By the time the big presidential debates came up, there were like three of them, I think, which are the sort of the main debates everybody looked at. Not once did one of the questioners ask a question related to those science questions. Isn't that weird?
You know, it's not weird when you think about the fact that anyone who would answer that question, okay, would be instantly unpopular. I mean, I remember I had this conversation. It was a couple of my sister's friends. We were at some restaurant or whatever, and I asked them a very simple question. I said that if everyone would be able to enjoy the same luxuries and rights that you have as an individual, but that would require you to lower your standard of living in half, would you do it? And they all said no, Matt. They all said fucking no. And you're like, oh, That's the fucking problem. No one wants to say, hey, guys, you know this whole great ride we've been having and shit? Not sustainable. We have to stop. And someone's going to be like, stop, what are you talking about? This party just got started. And then someone at the party's like, if we really kick it up a notch, Jesus is going to show up. Oh, great. Now things are really getting started.
Yeah, no, I don't know. You know, it's the whole sort of notion of Christianity as being this religion that is willing to make sacrifices and, you know, the common bond and the good Samaritan and love thy neighbor as thyself and all the rest of it. I mean, it's kind of ironic that you have this almost, you know, socialist aspect of the Bible that is completely and utterly ignored by these Christians in America.
Not just ignored. I don't know if you remember, but Conservapedia was saying that they were writing a Bible that removes removes the socialist aspect of it.
Really? Oh, that would be a. You know about that Thomas Jefferson apparently went through the Bible, taking out everything his expression was everything that is violent, despicable, untrue, or created by the priesthood.
Yeah, it's a thin novel.
Yeah, and it came down to 40 pages. He said they're the most beautiful 40 pages in the world.
Probably most of them from Songs of Solomon, I bet you.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in there. There's some heavy-duty screwing, for example.
Oh, fuck, yeah. I mean, it's like porn that probably people were reading back in the day. Like, this is the porn that they slipped in. And they're like, these are beautiful poems. I'm like, what are you talking about? This is fucking pornography, you fucking fool.
Yeah. That, like, you'd read the Bible hidden behind a camel saddle.
You're like, I love these verses. Oh, I bet you do, lonely fucking desert wanderer. Jeez.
Yeah, no, it's a strange old. But I hear you've got some pretty out there Canadians these days. I mean, last time I was there, I remember there was talk about some sort of fundamentalist movements, intruding on education and your private life.
Oh, yeah. It happens all the time. I mean, in Montreal, where I was, it's probably one of the largest Hasidic Jew population, and Orthodox Jew. And you know what their teachings are like. You also have in BC, I think in Bountiful BC, there's fundamentalist Mormons that sort of came up from Utah when they were trying to escape Americans telling them that they couldn't have a plurality of wives, which I would be fine with if that didn't include 14-year-olds.
Yeah, no, I know. It's like they don't want the numbers to get big. I mean, if you had 10 40-year-olds, that's like 400 years of wife you got there. Ugh. So maybe they like to sort of not think about that.
I don't know.
It's like that whole thing of having, like, the idea that you would, like, fly an airplane into the World Trade Center because you're going to get 72 virgins in the afterlife. But if the afterlife is eternal, 72 is going to wear thin pretty soon.
I don't think anyone – but to be fair, I mean, let's be fair. Anyone who has contemplated, seriously contemplated infinity has not had the exact best experience doing that, right? Just ask Godel. Hey, Godel, why did you spend months in an insane asylum? Oh, yeah, you were trying to fucking understand infinity, you know? Plenty of people have gone mad trying to understand the incomprehensible. So if you go to someone who's just likely to believe that heaven has rivers of honey and wine, like, I don't like those two things, maybe. You know, maybe that's not my fucking idea. It sounds definitely like someone who's thirsty and loves sugar. Well, okay, that does account for a lot of people, but maybe some folks that live around the water are not so glad. And if you die because you were drowned, trust me, you do not want to go to Muslim heaven, because you'd have trauma, man.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I'd want to be with 72 virgins. Anyway, I think I'd like a little experience to run
around. No kidding. And you know what the thing that I always
learn something new, you know?
The thing I always found funny is, and the virgin part of it is for me like the most important, because it definitely shows, like, if ever you want to tell someone, I believe that Islam has a real insecurity about women. And how can it prove this? Well, a huge part of their culture is like, let me show you the sheets stained with blood to prove that she had fucked no other man. And I'm like, are you ever worried actually about your own sexual competence? Because trust me, every fucking man is. So you've kind of figured out a way to make sure that doesn't happen, even in your heaven. Well, if it's just all perfect, why the fuck do you care if they're virgins? Why does it matter?
Yeah, no, it's there's a lot of nutty stuff around. But you also in Canada, didn't you have like a big Catholic scandal with Catholics and?
Oh yes, yes. Well, that actually it's come in waves. Because at first there was a big controversy in Quebec when the wall came down in the 1960s, something right. called the Quiet Revolution, where basically everyone decided that the Catholic Church needed to get the fuck out of town and stop controlling everything from education to hospitals and everything else like that. And when finally some news came out about how they were running orphanages, what a big surprise, so many people getting raped and abused. Oh, what a fucking surprise. Everyone was shocked by that news. But yes, we've had our share of that. I think the latter part of it has come, again, like you said before, from natives. I forget which report that is. I think I must have written about it, but it just talked about the strategy that was being employed by the government and obviously the church, how they wanted to convert people and put them in these just profoundly evil institutions. I mean, the history that Canada has, much of its blood, the blood on its hands and the terror that it's inflicted on Aborigines, I'm like, trust me, after the whole settlers, it was up to the church to make shit miserable.
Yeah, no, but you know what? I like Canada. I like Canada a lot. I've been there several times. And I was actually in a hotel fire in Toronto once.
Really? Did you set the fire, Matt? Did you set it?
No, no, but
clean.
I'll tell you.
Come on, come clean.
It was really strange. This was a long time ago when I was young and stupid as opposed to old and stupid. And I had gone to Toronto to show one of my first films at the festival there. And I had been invited to something that was called a Blind Pig, which was an illegal drinking establishment in
Toronto.
Why did it
have to be illegal?
I don't know, but it was an after hours place, and I drank through until the thing ended, like at 4 a.m. Then I went back to my hotel, which, as I remember, was quite a tall building, and I went to sleep. And in the morning, I woke up and I tried to call room service to get something to treat my hangover. The phone didn't work, so I put on some clothes and I come out of my room and it kind of smells a little weird, and I press the elevator thing and it doesn't work, and so I go down the stairs 10 flights and I come into and as I go down the stairs everything is getting blacker and blacker. When I come out in the lobby, it's black and there's like full of firemen.
Jeez.
And they said, what are you doing here? You know, there was a fire here last night, everybody was evacuated. And I was
last night, like how long had the fire been still going on?
Oh, it had been been quite a serious fire, and everybody was evacuated except me, who was so fast asleep after this Blind Pig experience that I just didn't notice it at all.
My goodness, that's quite a lot of drinking, I think.
It was. That was the good old days.
Wait, how old were you at this point? You were how young?
Exactly? Oh, 30.
30? That's like,
yeah.
Great. That's not really
maybe
that young.
Younger.
Yeah.
No, no, well, it's
like a little younger. 30, you're supposed to have a little. I'm like 31. I don't want to be that stupid. I like to something's right. Matt, what were you doing so wrong?
Oh, I don't know. I think I just got divorced. That's what it was.
Ah.
From my first wife, and I was just kind of completely celebrating.
Say, oh, I feel sorry for you, but I'm like, oh, celebrate. If you had perished in that fire, you know who you had to blame. Your celebratory sort of like crazy fest. But you know what? I would say, was it the orgiastic appeal of the, you know, glitz town? Did it just sort of like, did it enrapture you for, like, were you encapsulating that world? Because you sound pretty, like, down to earth. And that's what everybody told me. They're like, oh, he's just so natural to talk to, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what's going on? I felt like I was watching a Star Trek The Next Generation episode where everyone is always sucking Captain Picard's dick, like, all the fucking time. Yes, Captain Picard, like, and I'm like, what is happening here? Everyone is just so damn nice.
Yeah, well, I think what it is in my case is that I get sort of extra points for not being an obnoxious English person. You know, they expect you to be kind of snotty and uptight, and I'm not, which is so. You know, I'm just a sort of normal person, but I'm a normal person who they expect to be repulsive and undealable with.
They expect you to have it be an English gentleman of the sort of your ancestor. You know, you'd like to have a house that has a name. Did you name your house? I mean, that's a proud Darwin tradition.
No.
What? No! Okay, you have to fucking name your house now. World exclusive premiere. I want you to name your abode. It should be called that. Come on, man. You cannot drop this. This is an important part of, like, the whole legacy.
So why should you call it, like, down, you know, that Darwin's house was called Down House. Maybe I call it Down Two Bedroom Apartment on the East River.
That's one name. I don't know if we'll call that the final name. Maybe we should have a contest to get people to find a name. Because what was his father's house called? The Mount, I think.
Was it?
Yeah, I remember reading a biography of Darwin and noticing that at first he was like the biggest cock. Like, what a dick face! All he liked to do was shoot birds all day. The worst person. You're like, what the hell?
I know.
No, a waste of time. And like, then he goes to medical school, sees someone being operated on, totally wusses out. You're like, what the hell, man? And then he's like, I'm going to pick the clergy because it's the easiest thing to do. You're like, fuck, man, you are lazy.
Yeah, no, he was, I mean, that's why I've been asked several times, why don't you write something about Darwin? Why don't you write a movie? But, you know, he was a sort of a moderately kind of, you know, he drank and he hunted and did all the sort of things that English gentlemen at that time did. Then he gets on the Beagle, and that's like 5 years of weirdness, but it's kind of expensive to shoot. And also it's just, you know, looking at little animals and kind of going, wow, that's weird. Then he goes home with all his stuffed birds and worms and finches and all that stuff. And he sits there for 20 years kind of putting together this book that is then amazing. But then he doesn't come out and defend it. He's not a pugnacious guy.
Well, he had lots of successes before. I mean, his biography of the voyage is actually a bestseller. Like, everything he wrote, in fact, even on fucking, I think, Earthworms was a goddamn bestseller or something like that. Like, the guy just had a natural prose. I recommend, like, I actually, maybe that's part of something you inherited, because I do enjoy your prose, too. It's quite enjoyable. But yeah, you know, but not to disparage you, but your great-great-granddad is still fucking readable today. It's amazing. I love the commas. What are you talking about? If you've ever read any of my articles, I'm all about the comma. I may blame Darwin for this. I don't have time for periods, man. It's just, I gotta roll on. Period is too much of a pause. Need to move on. I need to break. I work at breakneck speed sometimes, so maybe. Apparently that's not J.D. Salinger. There was an author who made that really fucking famous. I'm trying to remember, like, entire pages would No, it's Kafka. Kafka, that's who it is. Kafka would write. Apparently it was, like, almost impossible to read because it's entire pages without punctuation. So I don't want to say I'm the Kafka of the atheism scene because I don't think I am.
Yeah. Well, it's that's a tough thing to live up to, because I love Kafka. I think he's great.
Tough thing to live up to. I don't have a famous ancestor. The most famous ancestor that I had, I think, was like a kind of scientist or something like that had like a nice little plaque from a president, and that's about as famous. I mean, that's not bad. But you, man, it's like you have that whole you see it all the time. You see the news. You see everybody just talking about your ancestor all the time. They don't give a shit about my
Yeah. Well, but I mean, that's a mixed blessing, isn't it? Because, I mean, most people, they grow up, you know, and they're taller than their father, they're smarter than their father, they're richer than their father. Look at me. What I've got is, like, Darwin was 6'2" and a genius. I'm 5'10" and a screenwriter. So, I mean, the comparison, you know, it's clearly an example of evolution going backwards. It's devolution.
Yeah, well, I mean, evolution is not necessarily a process of improvement, just of change. And you've adapted to the times. I mean, you're the modern gentleman. You go around, you do the whole glitz and glamour. I mean, okay, let's start talking about your movie, because we have to talk about the movie, and apparently I only have you for an hour. So, we have to talk about this. Unfortunately, I feel like a fucking idiot talking about it, because I haven't even seen it. I mean, I've done everything that I could to research. I even read spoilers, because I thought maybe I could fake it.
Well, I'll have to tell you the story then.
Okay, well, first of all, tell me this, because this is the first question that everyone's going to ask. Now, are there some hot and heavy scenes with Liv Tyler? That's the first question. Everyone?
They're actually... Yes.
Wait, what is that coughing?
Yeah, no, there is one scene that is kind of quite
fun. Spicy. Was it fun to film, by the way?
You know, I wish I could say it was, but I filmed a lot of sex scenes. I filmed a sex scene once with Helen Mirren when she was very young. A film I directed.
You didn't direct the sex scene for The Color Night, did you? Because I know you wrote the screenplay,
no.
But I was like, maybe you had some role in it. Because I know that Maxim called it like the sexiest sex scene, even though the whole thing was like nominated for countless Razzies. Actually, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, it was. I mean, that movie. When that movie came out, I went to see a screening of that film after I'd written it, and the director was this guy who'd done a really good movie, the name of which I've forgotten. He was called Richard Rush, but he'd done this very good movie, The Stuntman, with Peter O'Toole. So I had kind of high hopes for this, but the movie started off with a psychiatrist, played by Bruce Willis, talking to a patient. And then he gets bored with the patient. He sort of lies on the couch, and the patient sort of walks around the room. And then all of a sudden, she does a flyer. She jumps out the window and disappears. And I'm watching this thing, and she jumps out the window, and you see, like, Bruce Willis runs the window. He looks down. You see her falling. And then you cut to a shot from below, and she falls closer. And then you cut to a shot, like, through a window, and she goes past it. And then you cut to a wide
shot.
The
longest fall.
It's like a minute of this poor woman, like, shrieking her way down the building. And I thought, oh, my God, we are totally fucked here. So the guy's name was Richard Rush. And I was so disappointed in the movie.
Yeah, it did. It looks as though it did kind of kill his career, because the only thing I can find after is a documentary about the only movie that it sounds like he made right.
I don't know what was wrong with the guy. But anyway, so I was so disappointed by it. I went out and I got a poster that said that was penises of the animal kingdom. You know, it started like with man, and then it went up to dog, and then elephant, and then shark, and then whale. You know, like a whale has like a 22-inch penis. But so I had these like these pictures, and his name was Richard Rush. And I wrote on this thing, I wrote, but you're the biggest dick of all. And I rolled it up and I put it in a thing and I walked to the post office to send it to him because I was so angry that he'd screwed up what was actually quite a good script. As I was about to mail it, my wife called me and said, Richard Rush has had a heart attack.
No sympathy.
I had to. I pulled the poster back and I ran back home and destroyed it. That's not a bad segue into why I made The Ledge, because, you know, I was a Hollywood screenwriter for 20 years between my sort of early directing career and this thing. And you just see one movie after another get misdirected. And at this point, I thought, I want to screw up a movie all on my own. And so I'll write it and misdirect it, and at least I'll be responsible for the whole thing. So that's how I wrote this film that I really never expected to get made. And it did.
Particularly with an A-list cast, right? Like, how the hell did the whole process work? Because, I mean, I don't want to gossip too much, but Terrence Howard, the only thing I know about him as an actor is that he was blackballing a studio to, like, for Iron Man 2, and I'm like, is this a tough actor to work with, or is it just that he's the kind of guy that just picks up independent films and he doesn't care? Like, what's Terrence Howard's deal? Like, what the hell? Like, I was surprised that he was in the movie, because I'm like, didn't you turn down a shitload of money because you wanted more money? Like, I'm very confused.
Yeah, I don't know about Terrence. I mean, I liked him a lot, and I tend to get on well with actors, and you know, often you hear that an actor is difficult, and then you hear what the director was doing to them, and you think, you know, I'd be difficult in that situation. It's such a tough job being an actor.
I guess so, right? There's lots of different sides to a story, and all I see, I guess, from my limited perspective is you walked away from that much, but that's only because I eat ramen noodles, so I don't fucking understand that world. I'm like, oh, you turned down $20 million, you greedy fuck. You mean, like, do you know what I would do with $20 million? I'm like, I'd shake you around. I'm like, I would fucking change the world. And what are you doing with it? You're buying a fucking Lamborghini?
I know. No, I've seen it happen. You know, I was married to someone who became sort of briefly kind of a bit of a star. And you watch this process of isolation occur, yeah, where the agent is flattering them, the manager is flattering them, the public is flattering them, the publicist is flattering them, and they lose touch with their sort of real position in the real world. And it's, you know, I believe there's actually a psychiatric disorder called learned infantilism, which is this thing where you become a very, very famous person, and you actually, although you think of yourself as being like a big dog in the business, what you really are is you're a big baby, because whatever you want, you get. You know, you reach out your hand and there's a nipple and you can suck on it. You want a Lamborghini, it arrives. You want flattery.
That's what I want, Matt. I want a big nipple that I can just grab and suck it all the time.
Yeah, or even two. Yeah, these guys can have six. You can have six nipples. I want six nipples, a Lamborghini, a lot of sushi. It's a kind of a weird, it's a weird truth. You know, it is like being a baby. No one says no to you. You just sit in the middle of all this stuff and everything comes to you. And so you get this kind of infantile behavior, tantrums, inability to have sort of serious relationships.
Or empathy.
Yeah. And then there are people who survive, like Brad Pitt, for example, I am told, is an atheist. Did you know that?
I actually do. And you know what? I have the strangest relationship with Brad Pitt. I was writing about it in a thing I call The Good Atheist Companion. It's kind of like my behind-the-scenes thing about the book. And I talk specifically about an interview that Bill Maher, where he was on Bill Maher talking about not only atheism but also marijuana, which I'm like a huge fan of. But anyway, I was like, well, I had a hard time with Brad Pitt because when I was growing up, Brad Pitt was the man that everyone fucking compared them. You too! You're like, your attractiveness was compared to Brad Pitt. So I'm like, I had a fucking problem with him, but the guy happened to be in my favorite movie of all time, which is Fight Club, and I'm like, oh, now I can't hate you. And then I watched the whole Mayer interview, and he's like this hilarious, down-to-earth atheist dude who just loves to fucking smoke pot and try to save the world in his own kind of stoner way. And I'm like, fuck, man, I can't hate you anymore, even though my childhood was, well, at least my young sexual adulthood was ruined by you.
Was he was on the Bill Maher show, did he actually sort of come out as an atheist?
I'm trying to remember
pretty
if
close.
He did. If he didn't, yeah, he was just talking about religion being just a whole mess of mythical nonsense. But I think he declared himself to be mostly like a weak atheist, where it's like strongly agnostic, but he, you know, if you were to corner him down, he's like, no, there's no God. What are you talking about? But he's not like, say, me and or you, apparently, who's, you know, who decides he's going to kick shit around enough and say, I'm going to make a mainstream atheist protagonist against a Christian fundamentalist. That's pretty ballsy. I'll tell you what.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's Hollywood, weirdly enough, you know, although it's sort of thought of as being this sort of bastion of liberal degeneracy, it's actually quite conservative and religious or spiritual. I mean, of course, in the there's a lot of Jews that run Hollywood who go to temple and all of the rest of it. But there's also a heavy kind of, oh, I'm a very spiritual person and all that stuff.
Oh, it's just the left version of kind of like their religious idiocy, where it's like, I have chakras and nonsense.
Exactly.
And if you tell them that's all garbage, you're like, oh, you are intolerant. And blah,
yeah,
blah, blah. Closed-minded,
like, I believe, is the expression that's on the tip of your tongue over there in Canada.
It's called that by flat earthers. 2 days ago, closed-minded. By flat earthers, Matt. Flat earthers came to my site and called me closed-minded.
Yeah, no, it's a real peculiar set of people you got out there in the world. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, there is a sort of prejudice against atheism, and you know, actually there was a prejudice against making Passion of the Christ too. Because it was going to be anti-Semitic, I think people knew that. But as soon as it did well, as soon as the Christians came out and supported it, then everybody saw a sort of financial upside to making more faith-based films, and you get all these kind of, you know, there came a bunch of other ones, not unlike that, that had a sort of faithy kind of center to them. So that's, again, to go back to my film, I hope that atheists will come out and support my film, because if they do, it'll open the door for other directors to do other movies about the painful consequences of faith. And that would be a very good...
Which is the theme of the movie.
Yeah. Well, the movie, to give you this, I can't give you all of it because that would spoil it, but it starts with a guy climbing out onto a ledge about, and he's clearly going to jump at some point. A cop comes along, played by Terrence Howard, to try and talk him down, who's having his own crisis of faith in his marriage. And you quickly discover that the atheist is an atheist and he's not jumping by choice. Someone has given him a test of his lack of faith. Will he be capable of jumping off the ledge to save someone else's life, even though he, the jumper, has no faith in an afterlife? And it's a kind of a thriller as you discover what elements have brought him to this ledge. And needless to say, as Liv Tyler's in the movie, she's not uninvolved in that.
She allows. Well, she also, she's a kind of character who has a bit of a kind of past where she gets rescued by the I guess we could call the antagonist. But from everything that I've understood, like I would you say you tried to take measures to make sure that it wasn't characterizing someone as just merely, you know, like a fundamentalist who believes in crazy things, but rather a person who, like, who seems otherwise normal, like, say, the Lafferty brothers, who's just, their convictions in what they believe in gives them a kind of, an evil determination about the course.
Yeah, well, the character is, I mean, both the atheist and the fundamentalist. The atheist is played by Charlie Hunnam, and the fundamentalist is played by Patrick Wilson, one of the great actors in America, in my view. And both of them have suffered a great deal. And the fundamentalist has gone into faith as a way of kind of stitching himself back together and holding his fractured psyche together. And Charlie Hunnam, the atheist, has suffered a terrible, terrible loss. And he has become more defiantly atheistic. You know, how could a good God take this, as it happens, child away from me? You know, how could, you know, what, that doesn't make any sense. And he's very outspoken, aggressive atheist. But they have this in common, that they both suffered and have found ways to survive life's hardship. So yeah, I have sympathy with that character because I've met these people. You know, I think there are people around who, short of having $50,000 to spend on psychotherapy, faith isn't a choice for them. It's an absolute necessity. It's what holds them together. And he's one of those characters. And Liv Tyler plays the woman in the middle who they're sort of struggling to possess her soul or influence her soul, if you were to believe in souls, to influence her beliefs. It's a pretty intense film. I can honestly say that in all of the screenings I've had of the film, which must be like 10 by now, I've never seen anyone walk out of the theater once the movie has started.
Well, it's usually a good sign.
Yeah, it's an atheist message in the shape of a Trojan horse thriller. The Trojan horse is the thriller. Anyone can see this movie. You're going to like it because it keeps you on the edge of your seat. It's also very romantic as well and sexy.
let's recall here that this is Liv Tyler.
We're talking about a horse. Yeah. and inside it is this message, is this sort of debate about atheism versus faith, with, I would say, sort of fairly clearly, my preference is clear in the film.
I mean, I was watching many of the previews, and I guess the thing that struck me about them, at least, was the conversation between the main character, the atheist, and the fundamentalist, where the atheist is having conversations that I've overheard myself have, you know, 10,000 times, because again, I'm much more of the antagonist portion of saying, well, you know, until we rid ourselves of it, then we have a serious problem. Knowing full well, of course, that there are other people that kind of take many different positions on the subject, which kind of brings me on a bit of a tangent. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about someone that you've worked with in the past that is kind of on the other side of the atheist debate, which is Chris Mooney, whose book Unscientific American I remember reading, and he was saying, part of his argument was saying that the reason why science has become just so fragmented, especially the belief in evolution, is because we're doing a disservice, guys say like me or P.Z. Myers, doing a disservice by creating this dichotomy. Where do you find yourself on that spectrum? I mean, even particularly with the movie, because it kind of, does it deviate from there, or is it like, where would you say you stand on the issue?
I don't know. You know, Chris is a very good friend of mine, and I did an interview with him recently. And he's a very thoughtful, very smart guy. And I'm sure I would, you know, I think there are sometimes times where if you get too obnoxious in the wrong context, you do a disservice to the cause. And I think that if you don't recognize
those limits, kind of
thing? No, not so much limits, but if you don't recognize that a lot of people who've gone into faith have gone in there because they're really, you know, that society itself has made life intolerable for them, and it's just very difficult to keep a sense of community. There's kind of a whole mass of factors that can make someone stuck in there. And I do see that point of view, but what I really think is if you look at sort of feminism or gay rights, there was always 100 different ways of going at the problem. And with the feminists, you needed the women who burned their bras and grew...
That was actually, that never happened, by the way, apparently.
Really?
The whole bra burning thing? Yeah. I was reading an article about it. Apparently, mostly propaganda. Yeah, I know, eh?
Well, but I mean, okay, then let's look at the gay rights thing. You have a kind of a very outrageous set of people who have a very aggressive, you know, queer theory and all of that stuff.
And there's that segment of it that's very in your face. Like the parades are a good example of that. It's like, we're not going to shy away and we're going to get in your face. But there are also groups that put pressures in different ways or even get upset when in times where I think they necessarily should just chill the fuck out. But they have that spectrum. I wonder how they react to that spectrum.
You need it all. You need the sort of civilized, thoughtful, sympathetic, gentle advocate, and you need the person who's going to get the photograph in the paper. And so I don't think it's an either or choice. I think everybody should do what they can according to their nature.
Yeah, well, I've always felt that to some degree the only way that we can actually approach people and say, well, you can, there's no reason for you to believe, abandon it. I try to put the pressure on my fans, people who listen, to saying, well, you have to build a community now. You're telling these people abandon your beliefs, but they don't want to abandon community. So what are your fucking options? Well, you either build a community, which has been a huge and hard thing to convince atheists to do. Because apparently lots of them feel like, well, we don't want to be like religion. Be like, what about the good parts of it, you fucking dick faces? Like, forget about getting tricked into them telling you, oh, you're just like us. No, we're not. End of story. Like, I feel like we're always too worried about that kind of thing. So, you know, we're like, I don't know if I should support people who do this, or because that sounds like religion. I mean, even your movie, I mean, like, everyone who listens to this fucking show has an opportunity to support you. I mean, I'll be putting up links on the site in the notes. There's a link that people can go to and watch it on iTunes. Unfortunately, only if you're in the fucking U.S. you'll also be able to call in advance. There's some theaters where it's showing, if I'm not mistaken, and you guys need to have, like, the demand needs to be great, right? And in response, that'll change things.
Yeah, no, it's really important that it gets supported, because then it'll get out into the smaller towns in America where it really can. But to go back to what you were saying about the sense of community and so on, in a way, the logical consequence of democracy ought to be the loss of the necessity for religion. If people voted in a democratic way, as if they were voting their conscience, their religion, their sense of community, you wouldn't need the church. I mean, I think it's, if you look at the countries where that take care of their citizens really well and where people aren't terrified of being on the street because they can't afford the bill they've got from the hospital or because they've been thrown out of work without compensation. If you look at those places that have a society that functions in a democracy as a form of decency and humanity, then you don't need religion. But so long as you have these places where, you know, you have some people who are... I mean, the idea in America that tax cuts for the very rich is going to benefit the very poor, if that isn't the definition of Orwellian bullshit, I don't know what is.
In America, you will find people on Medicare that are trying to destroy Medicare.
Well, these Tea Party nitwits who don't have two nickels to rub together, who are kind of trying to keep all this stuff in place. It's just ludicrous. And part of the ludicrousness is a kind of such a sense that America is like so special, you don't need to look beyond its borders for good examples. But, you know, someone like me who's lived in Europe in various places, and I have a place in Brazil and I see how they do things down there, you can see so many ways in which cities and do better than American cities. You know, like the fact that Paris got rentable bicycles before New York did. I mean, like 5 years before. You know, we just got the same-sex marriage thing through in New York. I mean, that should have happened 30 years ago. Think of those 30 years of suffering that people have gone through, gay people have gone through, to get to this point, which is just such an obvious human right. Anyway, I could go on.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the gay marriage thing, because actually a fan of the podcast had sent me a letter, and I put it up because she was like, I'm thinking of coming to Toronto to get married, probably like the day before the legislation gets passed, because she's like, I live in Buffalo. And all of a sudden, right, she was ecstatic. She's like, I don't even think that's going to be necessary anymore. And you're like, well, I don't even know for how long that's going to be like that, because you know what? Next election, I bet you somebody squeezes that in, kind of like the same way they did with Prop 8, just be like, squeeze this bitch in, and next thing you know, a vote has decided whether or not you should have equal rights.
I don't know. I think it's a, you know, you can only, religion can only put the brakes on human decency for so long, and then it just has to give way.
But why aren't we tired of it? Like, why do we just keep watching the Catholic Church get away with not having prosecuted child abusers for report after report? And I mean, Matt, we don't even know what the fuck is going on in Africa now, because that's where they sent all their worst ones.
Africa. If you will indulge me a minute, because I had a very, very – the last screening I had in Sundance – this is a really interesting story. The last screening I had in Sundance took place on the night after the day that a Ugandan gay rights activist called David Kato was beaten to death with a hammer. And I know that – you know, we all know that that there are a lot of evangelical homophobic Christians going into Uganda – to export the shit that they're having a little more trouble selling in this country. So they had been there stirring up this homophobia and then saying, oh, it had nothing to do with that. So in the last screening at Sundance, I'd been very polite up to this point. I introduced the film and I said, I want to dedicate this film to my friend Christopher Hitchens, to Ayan Hirsi Ali, a genitally mutilated Muslim woman, and David Kato, who was beaten to death with a hammer yesterday, quite likely as a result of evangelical Christians going in there and stirring up an existing homophobic atmosphere. And a woman at the back said, that's nonsense, that's nonsense. And I said, well, I'll see you after the screen. The movie was screened. I came back from my apartment that was rented around the corner for me with the clipping. And I came back and I was furious. This idea of this guy being beaten to death and all of these things that sort of mounted up inside me for a while. And I got up there and I said, I just want to say this about religion. And, you know, there's always an apart from clause in you religious people, apart from homophobia, apart from the fact that we're discouraging condom use in AIDS-infested Africa, apart from this guy who just got killed, apart from genital mutilation of women, apart from the denigration of women, apart from sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, apart from the Inquisition, oh, it's all okay. It's not all okay. There's a lot of cruelty here. A lot of people are suffering, and it's not a minor issue that we're talking about here. So one person stood up and said, yeah. Another person said, I disagree with that completely. And I don't know how you have the nerve to denigrate this. And we're all not like that. And it got very heated. And all of a sudden, a woman, it turned out that in the audience was a group from the Fuller Seminary in Orange County, which it's kind of a fairly evangelical, conservative seminary. A woman stood up in the back and said, I'm from the Fuller Seminary. And I noticed that tears were streaming down her face. And she said, I just want to apologize for all the harm my faith has done to people like you. I think she assumed because I'm a great advocate of gay rights that I was gay. But nonetheless, it was kind of a fantastic.
You're British. You're all gay.
Yeah, exactly. Americans. Yeah, that was the other reason. Yeah, there's two reasons rather. But it was fantastic. And then the whole theater went completely silent. And I said, well, thank you. And everybody left. Well, among the people in the audience that day was this guy called, I can't remember his name, but he has a blog or something, and he calls himself the culturally savvy Christian. The next few days, things began to sort of buzz about this thing, and the culturally savvy Christian wrote a thing saying, you know, it's not a bad film, but The Fundamentalist is completely overblown. He's, you know, no one is really like that, and all that stuff I know I'm going to get from other people, you know, that this is like a cartoon character. I know this man. I've seen him 100 times in my travels through America. He's not a cartoon at all. But he wrote that. Over on the other side, the Fuller Seminary people began to sort of discuss the whole thing, and they were saying, yeah, there's nobody like that in America. That fundamentalist in the film is just a preposterous, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then the culturally savvy Christian, I don't know if he's just naturally kind of feisty, he wrote to them and he said, well, you know, actually, having criticized me for what I had written about, you know, this fundamentalist character who I'd invented, he said, actually, you know, I got to tell you a story. After I got my divorce, I was going out with a Christian woman. And when she went back home to her father to tell him that she was going out with a divorced man, he pulled a gun on her and said, if you continue to see this divorced man, you're in trouble. So everybody has one little story of where they've met one of these people. But depending on which side of the debate you're on, you kind of say, well, that probably means there's a hell of a lot of these people out there. Or you go, oh, well, that was just one quirky little incident. But isn't that interesting? Yeah. There's one guy who's like buzzing around all over America, freaking people out. Yeah, no, you didn't by any chance read my piece in Huffington Post the other day about, called The Atheist in the Closet?
No, but I did listen to the interview where you talked about your admiration of the gay rights movement and their ability to capitalize on
it. Yeah, well, I wrote this piece for Huffington Post called The Atheist in the Closet, which also came out of this Iowa conference where, you know, I met all these kind of soldiers, but also a lot of people who were closeted atheists in their own community because it was just too painful to come out. So I wrote this article for the Huffington Post about the sort of similarities between being gay in America and being atheist in America. I mean, the gays get beaten up more, have a worse time in that respect, but the atheists are actually more disliked. So I got over 500 comments on the article, which is a hell of a lot. People writing and saying, yeah, I tried to come out in my community, people stopped talking to me, or I came out and after a while it got better. And it was a real, you know, it's very interesting because it's thought, you know, if you look at the poll on atheists in America, it represents about 4%, with a further 12% who say, I don't know what I am, I have no faith at the moment, or I don't belong to any particular religion. If you look at the gay poll that came out after the 2008 election, where they exit polled people and asked them their sexual preference, and 4% said they were gay, lesbian, or bisexual. So the numbers are kind of equal. Although, again, you know, like on the atheist side, you had the people who said, actually, I have no particular religion. There were others who said, well, I'm not gay, but I had a couple of experiences that were gay. So you've got this kind of similar numbers, similar issues, and but the gays, in a way, are way, way ahead of us because of the whole issue of coming out. And this idea that if more atheists came out of the closet and were sort of more open about it, then people would see that we're not monsters. We're actually decent, thinking, humane people.
Well, let me ask you this question, because this is ultimately the kind of the flip side of that, because this is something I think about quite a lot. I have a fan who's in Pakistan, and this fan has been like, I suppose I have fed probably into his desire to want to identify himself as a non-believer, right? Through just some of the things that I've said. Not directly, in fact, if I had conversations with him, it's like, please be fucking careful. But there's that whole notion that, like, when we make it more acceptable everywhere else, we do recognize that there is going to be consequences. You know, if you're going to celebrate in the trance of humanity, you kind of have to partake in some of its burdens. And I think that to some degree that's going to mean that every step that we take forward is going to have some consequences somewhere else. Like, do you feel some degree like, does that make you nervous? Does that upset you? Do you think about these kinds of things?
Oh, very much, yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously, there's a great difference between coming out as an atheist in America and coming out as an atheist in
Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia or Iran or Pakistan even. But if we can't even do it here, how can we expect them ever to do it there? And you know, sometimes there are situations where it's really impossible, and I kind of understand that. But I think it's – I just think we have a lot to learn from the gay rights movement. And, you know, it's fantastic to me. I mean, I don't know if you know anything about my past. My uncle was gay, and he and his boyfriend have been together for 50 years. And my film is dedicated to them, actually. There's a gay character in my film who sort of triggers the whole
– debate.
The whole thing in a way, yeah. And, you know, my uncle and his boyfriend, partner, now husband – were together for 50 years, are still together after 50 years. 30 of those years, or 20 of those years, they, if they had come out, they could have risked up to 30 years in prison. So, you
for
know,
sodomy, right? Like, that was the sodomy laws?
Yeah, it was, yeah, I can't remember what the exact wording of it was, but it was, there was literally, in my lifetime, a law on the books in England that could send you to prison for 30 years for being gay. I mean, that is just so outrageous. You can't expect those people to come out. But you see how far we've come in those years in the gay rights community. And I think atheists are behind that. And I wonder if there isn't some alliance that could take place between the gay rights movement and the atheist rights movement, if you like. In that I've never met a homophobic atheist, I don't think.
I think I met a few, but to be honest, you're always going to find the
yeah.
section of people who identify themselves as non-believers, but who don't necessarily have a very strong skeptical mind. It's like, I actually think it's for some people. I mean, you were talking about how it's necessary for some rather than spend countless hours in psychotherapy. I also think that there's probably a side, like a kind of genetic predisposition, and I talked about this with Andy, which was lost. Mm-hmm. But anyways, what we managed to talk about was the fact that, you know, we would tend to see a deviation, a kind of different degrees of attachment to, say, that, you know, the needs that religions fulfill, the kind of junk food that it is for the mind. Like, it would appeal to some much more than others. And there's going to be some people that will never be religious, even if you tried to jam it into their brains, and some people who are never going to be irreligious, even if you just explained it to them nicely. There's just something about their brains which is either prone to belief or disbelief. I do think that there are those that are like that. So definitely you could see on one side of the spectrum a person prone to disbelief about God, but who may still be completely and utterly uneducated about absolutely everything else.
But I bet if you took us as a group, we would be one of the least homophobic and most pro-gay rights groups in America.
I would agree. I would.
I mean, more so than Democrats, you know, more so than, you know, I don't know what, apart from the gay rights movement itself, but
or Jews, like there's plenty of Jews that feel that homosexuality is wrong. So there's,
yeah, yeah.
Even though they have a very strong history of liberalism. So
yeah.
you're right. I do believe that. And definitely many of my fans are gay. I do cater to that. But I always felt like the goals were just so similar in so many respects. You're like, so much of homophobia is caused by religious belief specifically. I mean, it's not just a coincidence. I'm like, they have a problem with it in their holy fucking book. And they decided to make it an issue rather than the whole, you know, wearing two different cloths or not cooking your bread with human shit. They kind of,
right.
They kind of lost those rules.
Yeah. Well, you know, My feeling about Christianity in America is that it's like Moses wearing a Jesus outfit. You know, they front with Jesus, but the actual sort of ethic behind it all is this kind of disapproving, punishing Moses view of life. You know, Deuteronomy and stoning people to death, and that's what's really in the heart of that apparent Jesus figure that you see on Sundays in America. Often. I mean, I'm maligning a far too big of a group in that statement. But
oh, well, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about your movies, your projects, your books. I wish we had more time to talk about all those subjects. I'll be providing a different show with a review of the movie, my own review. Hopefully this is after we've interviewed, because who knows if you'll like me after.
Oh, no, I do, and I would definitely do this again. And just tell your audience, go and see the movie in New York and Los Angeles on July 8th. It's playing in two theaters. It opened in 200 theaters in Russia. It's opening in two theaters in America. And unless it does well in those theaters during the first 2 weeks, it's available on video on demand and iTunes. Unless it does well, it'll be very hard to make another one of these, and we should have a lot of them.
Well, I agree. Definitely it's going to be something that we're going to be pushing on the site for as much as we can. Fortunately, we're tiny and insignificant, but only for now.
Every little helps. You know, you never know where the virus starts.
You never know. All right. Well, with that, I'd like to thank my guest, Matthew Chapman. Thank you so much for being on the show, and hopefully you'll be a guest on it again when you do some other exciting project.
Thank you. And you know how to get hold of me, right?
I sure do. Well, other than your Skype totally refusing to let me know that you're on, I do have your contact information.
So you can always find me, and I'd always be happy to come on. It's been a good laugh.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
See you later.